colonialism is not a thinking machine, nor a body endowed with reasoning faculties. It is violence in its natural state.
Welcome to Saving Europe from Itself with me, Zoe Williams from The Guardian, and my co-host, Luke Cooper from the LSE. On this special series of podcasts from the Another Europe team, we take one big idea from one big thinker and put it through its paces. Today, we look at the idea of a decolonized Europe, free from the shameful history of empire and truly open to the world. We're delighted to be joined by Priyamvada Gopal, an academic at Cambridge University and author of Insurgent Empire, Anti-Colonial Resistance and British Dissent. She asks if Europe is a colonial invention, should we just abolish Europe?
Europe is literally a creation of the Third World, wrote Frantz Fanon, the brilliant psychiatrist and political theorist. He was speaking about the wealth that was the foundation of that continent's prosperity. Wealth brought in, quote, from the ports of Holland, the docks of Bordeaux and Liverpool, and extracted from the labor of millions of enslaved Africans, as well as colonial plunder. When there was talk of aid for underdeveloped nations, he said, there was no need for the formerly colonized to tremble with gratitude. On the contrary, it was Europe that needed to reflect on how it came to be the mighty entity that it had become, one whose ideas and practices had attempted to shape the world in its image, with often devastating consequences. Another theorist would be less matter-of-fact, but equally insightful. Europe is indefensible, pronounced Aimé Césaire, poet-politician, in his thundering 1950s French polemic, Discourse on Colonialism. Writing in the immediate post-war period, Césaire was invoking the many civilizational and cultural claims made by Europe that failed to recognize its creation in the crucible of colonialism. Europe provided elaborate alibis for its historical misdeeds by closing its eyes to the problems it had created, seeking refuge instead in the hypocrisy of claiming that it was bringing civilization or development to benighted backward regions. If Europe is that entity which Césaire and many others involved in the struggle against colonialism deemed morally, spiritually indefensible, how do many of us from former colonies, British, French, Dutch, Belgian, German, Portuguese, Spanish, Danish, find ourselves in the curious position of calling for Britain to remain in an economic and political formation based on Europe? Are we naive and ahistorical? In fact, looking away from Europe and the world-altering consequences of its empires is not an option for us. For us, Europe is a paradoxical formation. We recognized, among other things, that the same Europe which imposed the nation-state form across the globe and effected innumerable lethal partitions of land in doing so also contains within itself the seeds of a counter-movement, as all large entities and ideas inevitably do. The paradox of Europe as the European Union is that it has both one of the globe's most lethal borders between itself and the darker nations, and internally the relatively recent practice of a great idea, the free movement of peoples and their right to choose where they give their labor. Many South Asians like me who have had to live with the hard, impermeable and violent borders imposed by a retreating British Empire are drawn to the idea of dissolving those borders. To take this possibility to its logical conclusion, however, Europe must decolonize. Ending free movement in Europe is not the way to extend free movement to the rest of the world. Decolonization invites us all to think about how we might undo some of the lethal legacies of empire, the concentration of wealth, income inequality, resource grabbing, sweated labor, hard borders, and selective free movement. Another Europe must be a decolonized Europe in a decolonized world.
Priya, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Let's talk about the big picture first of all, because this idea that Europe was founded on colonialization, are we talking about slavery or the exploitation of resources or the exploitation of markets? Is there a kind of preeminent way of in which Europe asserted itself?
So when we talk about Europe today, when we talk about the world today, the economic system, which we all, in some sense, have to be under, is capitalism. And the rise of capitalism and the wealth created for what we call the developed countries, the countries of the West and a few outside the West, that wealth is founded on capitalism, which has consolidated itself over the last 4 to 5 centuries. Mm-hmm. And that consolidation overlaps with both slavery and colonialism. So the wealth on which capitalism founded itself and founded the factories which produced wealth are intimately tied up to both slavery and colonialism. So I would say that it's all related. There is the extracted free labor of plantation slavery, which almost all the European empires had. But then there's also land, resources, plantations. After slavery, there was indenture widely practiced across the European empires, including the British Empire. So you can't really separate the history of wealth creation under capitalism from empire and slavery and colonialism.
It's really interesting, isn't it? Because a lot of people talk about the hard stop of capitalism being the finite globe, being, you know, an environmental hard stop. But actually what you're saying is the hard stop of capitalism is once you've run out of people to exploit, it doesn't generate its own momentum and productivity. Is that true?
I think it is true that once you run out of resources, labor, and markets, there's nowhere else to go.
So maybe we should start seeing ourselves as also environmental factors. You know, there is a kind of anthropomorphic climate change, but there are also people who have been exploited as much as oceans and soil.
But I wanted to ask another question. How much of the criticism you're making is to do with French imperialism? I know this is very dangerous territory for a British guy to make, but, you know, Césaire, Fanon, they're both critics of this European, like France is a particularly European empire, if that makes sense. It almost sees itself as this kind of universal, like, empire. But my question is, does the criticisms of the British, which are all founded on similar arguments, but it's not quite the same Europeanness.
One of the fictions that the British Empire managed to spin around itself very successfully was that it was different, that it was not a European empire, that it was, in fact, the moral empire. So frequently the connections with the French Empire were made as a way to exonerate what Britain was doing. Historians of empire will tell you that that in some ways is a post-World War II fiction, that it was after World War II, once Britain threw its weight along as a junior partner alongside America, that it became a not European empire. In fact, the British Empire, French empires, Dutch, Portugal, and so on, they were interlinked. I mean, they fought over the same pieces of land in Africa and in the West Indies. They fought each other over areas of influence. So actually, the separation of the British Empire from other empires is actually part of British exceptionalism. And I think British exceptionalism is now part of the problem.
Part of the problem of Brexit.
Were they seeking to separate themselves on moral grounds, i.e. we're better at it and more humane? Or were they seeking to separate themselves on grounds of success? You know, we just had a bigger empire and everybody else's empire was rubbish.
I suppose both are true in the sense that, yes, the British had a bigger empire, but the French one was not small. It was a good second. I think the separation was frequently strategic and political and pragmatic to say that whatever excesses we might be accused of or whatever violence we might be accused of, look at King Leopold, how terrible he is. And it also allowed for another very foundational and beloved British story, which is Britain as the fount of freedom and Britain as the kind of, not the slave empire, but the slave abolition empire, right? So it's quite an interesting story. Whereas if you look back in the 19th century, that's not quite the picture. It's not at all clear that the British are the moral empire in any sense.
In any meaningful way. No, it's true. But can you look at French self-fashioning and say they also see themselves as liberators as well as exploiters? Yes. I mean, is that...
Yes, you can see that in the French context very much, and you can also see very similar kinds of amnesia, state-enforced amnesia around empire. But to just go back to Luke's earlier point about my references here to Césaire and Fanon, what is interesting is that the most profound polemics against empire come, actually. I think you've touched on a correct point, that they come out of that French context. Why that is an interesting question. But I've just finished writing a book on British anti-colonialism. And actually, the materials are there. There are very profound polemics within Britain and outside Britain against the British empire. But interestingly, I think they fall into the margins more profoundly than some of the better-known French.
Maybe you could give us an example, because obviously you've got the new book out at the moment. That would be really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, there are several people. So in the 19th century, I look at people like the Chartist Ernest Jones, who articulated a critique of the British Empire back in 1857. He was very clear that the same people who were exploiting the British working classes and who were against the Charter and who were lining their own pockets were the same people who were out there in the Empire killing black and brown people. So he was calling for solidarity across class lines between black, brown and white. And this was in 1857. Later on, you have people like Wilfred Blunt, who starts out as a Tory and becomes what he himself describes as a passionate Egyptian nationalist. And he becomes one of the people pleading for Britain not to invade Egypt and not to be a violent force in the Middle East. Later on, you have people living in London, people like C.L.R. James and George Padmore, who are black Britons of a sort. They're also from the Caribbean, and they're articulating the most incredible nuanced criticisms of empire and of race ideologies and of the costs of empire for both black and brown people.
And that links to the next question, because what I really liked about the argument that's also distilled into the Guardian column, so you should go out and buy the book and read the Guardian column combined, but this argument that actually decolonial thinking and education is a way that can unite British, white British working class histories and show that they were completely entangled with and bound up with imperial histories, that they're not separate. Yeah. And I just thought that was, you know, such a solidaristic and unifying intervention in a debate, which sometimes it's hard to find the bridges in this debate.
Yeah. I mean, I often tell my students when, you know, my students will often divide into British students who describe the empire in terms of we and us, and students of colour who will say, you know, us referring to the colonies. And one thing I point out to them is that these pronouns are very, very complicated, because the history of empire is precisely a history of entanglement. And there is not one of us sitting here in London today, in Britain today, who is not shaped by that very huge and long-lasting history of empire. So yeah, curiously, rather than be polarized when it comes to thinking about empire, it's actually the common ground that we can think about how we came to be the way we are and how we relate to each other. We actually have a common history, and that common history is the history of empire. And I'm not the first person to note this. The people I've just been referring to were very clear that the empire actually made us part of the same historical political project. We have different relationships to empire, but it is nonetheless the common ground.
I was just thinking about how kind of epic that is, because actually a lot of the problem with the kind of Remain argument and with the Remain and Reform argument is that people don't see it as plausible that you would have transnational solidarity between, let's call it, kind of working class blocks across borders. The working class is formulated as a kind of naturally nationalist entity.
Yeah.
And that would be a huge win if we could just remake the natural working class or precariat identity, by definition, a transnational one.
Yeah, absolutely. The people I talk about in the book, and who, some of whom I've just mentioned, are very clear about that, that the working classes or ordinary people, and indeed in the case of some of them, women, have a relationship to empire which is not one of power, which is not one of becoming wealthy through the imperial project. And they're very clear that a solidarity has to cut across racial and national lines by definition, because for one thing, capital is not national. Capital operates across border lines, across national lines. And so it stands to reason that, you know, people working at the sharp end of capital are also exist across racial lines.
That again is interesting, because the whole, typically when you have a conversation about colonialism and post-colonialism and decolonialism, the underpinning principle is that, you know, we have to accept that everybody will go into decline.
Hmm.
Once you're no longer exploiting people, then everybody's in decline. But actually, that's not right, is it? Because most people were not benefiting from the incline.
No, they weren't. I mean, it's not as though ordinary British people had a huge amount to gain from empire. Having said that, it is worth noting that the welfare state in wealthier countries did rely on the wealth that came from colonialism and the wealth that was created by colonialism. But that does not mean that, therefore, welfare can only be thought of along national lines. One of Europe's relatively modest successes, but successes nonetheless, are that there are welfare states across Europe, and there are welfare states that they're not socialist dreams, but they are significantly more social democratic than Brexit Britain. So really, the question of whether being a nation on your own will mean that you will have a stronger welfare state or a stronger social democratic model, I think it's quite clearly the case that that is not necessarily so, that you don't have to have a welfare state that is defined solely on national lines. And in fact, it is something that we should think about rolling out globally. We should be thinking about things like a global minimum wage, because otherwise we have a situation where the minimum wage in European or in wealthier countries is dependent on the sweated labor of people in African and Asian and Latin American countries.
And I suppose to go back but also move on, I guess what I meant in my first question was Europeanness is something that French imperialism was very keen to mobilize. And as you said, British exceptionalism was always a kind of a non-European-ness, like a, say, you know, maybe a classic example would be Churchill in his Zurich speech, where he says Europe should unite, have a federal structure, you can share the wealth of your colonies and stuff like that. You know, it's all deeply embedded in imperialism still, but we've got the Commonwealth, we've got North America, we've got the Empire, so we'll go our own way. And that argument, as we've discussed a few times on this podcast now with a few different people, looked like it was defeated with the 1975 referendum, kind of Britain finally moving on from this exceptionalism, but it kind of came back with a vengeance in the 21st century.
Yeah. It begs the question, though, about whether that story is true. When I look at the Commonwealth, I see a degree of kind of amusement and bemusement at Brexit. There is no particular keenness to be involved with Britain as a Commonwealth. You know, the Commonwealth is busy being capitalist and expanding in its own right. I mean, the expanding economies of India and Brazil and South Africa are not looking to Britain. They're actually running their own empires, as it were. Now, it's a whole different story, of course. So there's an even more mythological dimension to that now, because no one's really looking to Britain. And this idea of, I mean, you know, this is, it's just a reality. You know, it's America is America first. And America is in a kind of complicated relationship with China. And there is a real danger that maybe, unlike Churchill's time, Britain really has no major role to play in world affairs except as a junior partner to America. And it's not even clear that it does so in that way.
And there is a peculiar paradox of it, though, because I completely agree with what you just said, but I did a podcast with Niccolò Milanese, who makes the point that, on the other hand, the whole world is talking about Brexit.
Yeah.
I mean, my partner listens to a Chilean podcast to keep her Spanish ticking over, and they're talking about Brexit going, what are these people doing?
Yeah.
They just, like,
yeah,
it does, yeah, not, yeah, compute, yeah, at all.
But that doesn't put us onto the world stage, does it? That just makes us a laughing stock.
No, but I suppose that is a kind of legacy of, I don't know,
of cultural influence.
Yeah, of empire in a way.
But it is worth saying also, and I referred to this a few minutes ago, that people who have grown up and live with the reality of the India-Pakistan border and how painful and bloodied that border was, certainly I regard with horror the prospect of border troubles between Ireland and the United Kingdom again. I think it's being treated with a degree of lightness, which again relies on an amnesia, both about that specific border, the pain of which is not that far back in history, and the realities of the borders that Britain left behind through partition and other places.
That's also one of the ironies of colonialization or being a successful colonizer, is that it is brutalizing. It's ethically, morally, and politically brutalizing to be that colonizer, but it's also a long way away. So people are kind of soft and idiotic at the same time as talking this brutal language. And I really feel that strongly about the Irish, whether it's Kate Hoey saying, you know, let's have a return to the Troubles. We know what no surrender means.
And, of course, coming from Northern Ireland, I'm very proud that Boris Johnson has actually called the called the Benn Bill a surrender bill, because we know all about no surrender.
Or Owen Paterson saying there'll be technical solutions. There's something very, very kind of facile and careless.
Indeed.
You know, like a playful about it. Yeah.
But it's also about the blood of other people. The partition in India, for instance, relied on somebody who barely knew the region, was there in the continent for 6 weeks, drew some arbitrary lines. And I think that in some of the comments that you've just alluded to, there is a callousness that has forgotten the human cost of borders and the human cost of setting up strict nation states and militarized nation states.
But I wonder, in a sense, whether that again has kind of forced the difference between kind of continental Europe and Britain, even while we're engaged in the same project, mainland Europe and us, even though a huge part of it is the kind of exceptionalism, which we've talked about a lot. There seems to be a kind of watchfulness in Europe, having just been, you know, war-torn in a different way, a watchfulness around the language of nationalism and hyper-nationalism, a watchfulness around the institution of borders and what they mean, which British politics at the moment just doesn't have. And I worry that we never had it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think in part that is because there have been imperial mythologies which have sought in very calculated ways to leave out the human cost of empire, and also the human cost of decolonization. There is a real fantasy in Britain that decolonization was very bloodless and it was all very beautiful. And then, you know, Britain just gift-wrapped freedom and gave it to her colonies, where in fact there was insurgency after the Second World War. Britain was completely embroiled, as was France, in putting down insurgencies, Malaya, Cyprus, Kenya. You know, there was, of course, the Suez affair. And I think that fantasy of bloodlessness underlies the callousness that we see around us today, because I think in bumping up its role in the Second World War, Britain has very deliberately left out the equally bloody and terrible conflicts that decolonization involved.
So, I'm not sure if this is a philosophical question or a political question or neither of those things, but would you agree that the struggle to give Europe a definition is necessary? Otherwise, it will be defined by the neoliberal centre, it will be defined by the centre-right, and in a most harrowing way, as we're seeing now, the new far-right. And this is different in mainland Europe compared to Britain, for the reasons we've discussed, is fighting to give Europe a definition. And that definition is that it's a white space, that it's at risk of takeover by Muslim invaders, and we must defend this Europe that's at risk, and all of this civilizational language mobilized around it. Because I wonder what Fanon would say about that in a way, or what he would say about another Europe is possible, because he's sort of saying something a little bit different in his argument.
Well, this is a difficult question, and it's a question that anti-colonial nationalists struggled with. They saw that the nation was a very useful form to resist the colonizer, to resist Europe, to resist imperialism. But they also understood that nation could turn into its own very problematic entity. And I think something of similar wariness inflects my attitude to Europe, which is I can say, yes, you know, we might want a pluralist, democratic, socialist understanding of Europe that we would pit against the culturalist, Christian, white, racialist understanding of Europe. But I think that as with nation, we must be cautious about what Europe can also become if we're too sharp about those definitions. When I've said that Europe's borders are lethal, I do mean that, that it is kind of ironic that the same entity which has free movement within itself is viciously racialized and violent in policing that border. There's not Europe that is outside Europe. And I think that if we're serious about another Europe, then I think we need to start thinking in terms of fuzzier boundaries between entities like Europe and Asia and Africa. I would say the same thing for India, that I see the nation, which was once an anti-colonial nation, now turning in on itself and oppressing populations like the Kashmiris within it, you know, or what it sees as population within its boundaries. So I think we have to be careful about definitions. They are useful, but they also have to be provisional and attentive to fuzziness.
I mean, I'm just thinking on that subject of fuzziness. It's very difficult to have a conversation about decolonializing without a conversation about reparations.
Yeah.
And I don't know who in Europe is ready for that conversation.
Yeah.
It feels like America has got much further down that road than Europe has.
It's not going to be Europe that will have the conversation about reparations. The conversation about reparations right now is being led by the Caribbean nations.
Right.
It is the nations who demand reparations who are going to lead that conversation. We know that the Mau Mau warriors in Britain got some compensation and some grudging acknowledgement from the state. So I think it is actually people leading the struggle against empire and remembering decolonization who will lead that struggle.
But if we want to be part of a reformed European project, do we have to build into that some idea of what you owe and what
I would say that is the case, that remembering how Europe came to be, remembering what, you know, Fanon and Césaire are talking about, you know, remembering how wealth, but not just wealth, so much of European culture, European literature, European languages, European music. I was listening to Radio 3 the other day, and I was listening to what I thought was, you know, music from the Middle East. And actually the announcer came on and said this was a Spanish composition. And I, at that moment, I just thought, yeah, these borders make no sense because, you know, food and clothing and music and language and literature bleeding into each other. These are the fuzzy boundaries.
But that's the funny thing.
We have no choice but to start talking about it, because if you look at something like welfare state chauvinism, in that unites probably the centre-left and far-right in maybe most European countries, certainly many.
Yeah.
And that's totally bound up with the whole reparations question and
unequal
development.
Whenever you talk to green remainers or, you know, environmentalists, a part of any international project, they always say that nature knows no boundary, no borders, wildlife knows no borders. You know, rainfall knows no borders, but they seem to say that as though that's a special case, but really
maybe none of us do. I don't want to be facile. I take the point about, you know, needing definitions provisionally and strategically in order to enact certain things, but I think we need to understand them as strategic and provisional.
Well, I think we could, you see. I think at a time when there is no kind of solidarity across borders between classes, then your democratic agency is bordered and you need your border in order to have democratic agency.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't have the agency of a trades union movement across the continent, if you don't have the agency of meaningful democratic levers within the institutions of Europe, then you really do need a bordered United Kingdom so that you can have your democratic identity and have it fulfilled. Although, as we've seen, that doesn't really work. But you need, you know, I can see the Wolfgang Street point here.
But you have to be attentive to the dangers and you have to be attentive to ossifying those borders.
And also it has to be agile, because presumably as soon as we do have transnational solidarity and as soon as we do have great levers between us and the institutions of Europe, then it won't matter so much what our democratic institutions are in the UK.
We certainly should begin to imagine what it might look outside of the nation-state framework.
We've discussed before, do you think it's possible to separate the idea of citizenship from the idea of the nation state or from the idea of Europe? Because actually lots of these power relations seem to come down to citizenship, like privileges that British nationals have as British nationals, privileges that they have as part of the European structure. If you can take those citizenships and raise them to a higher level that's more unifying, that's more international, that seems good. But then, do you have the issue that any concept of citizenship belonging has to still come back to a place?
As you say, it's a difficult question, but one thing I would point out is that a lot of people live in areas where they do not have citizenship, and a lot of people do not have citizenship where they live. So actually, the reality is that there isn't a strict mapping on of citizenship to nation states. My own attitude to citizenship in many ways is that it also changes. It's provisional. If you're a resident of a particular area, you might have rights. People have spoken about the ways in which, for instance, if you give labor somewhere, then you should have voting rights, regardless of what your nationality is, that we might want to think about ways in which certain kinds of rights are connected to labor rather than birth or race or nation. So I think that one can separate. If we define citizenship as a certain set of rights, those rights can be tied to things like residency and labor rather than nation. They're travel documents in one sense. Your passport is a travel document. I mean, I find the debate around, you know, a blue passport, people now have passports with the European Union already removed. And I just think this is ridiculous. This is a travel document. That's all it is. And why would you give it so much existential weight?
Well, it has existential weight as soon as the other side takes that weight. So I would never previously have given a shit what colour it was or what it said on it. Now I really, really care.
Right.
Also, I mean, I've learned recently that in the Latin American states, their equivalent of the European Union, Mercosur, they don't have free movement, but free movement is something that's very bound up with European citizenship, right? And that contains lots of problems. And actually the system they have, I wouldn't say better, but you could make the argument that it's a bit better, because they basically say there's an assumption against deportation in our labour market. And our labour market rules are to do with human rights, and labour market rights are human rights.
Yeah. But there's more than deportation, isn't there? I mean, there is, as you say, the vote, although, of course, European citizens don't have the vote here either. I mean, I'm very uncomfortable with tying rights to labour, because I think part of the problem with the last 10 years has been this assumption of economic productivity as your calling card.
Sure. And
I think that...
I wasn't saying only with labour.
No, it would certainly
give you some rights if you're giving your labour within a particular set
I mean,
of boundaries.
I kind of prefer residency as a marker.
Yeah.
And I think it's faintly absurd to be a country where you spend half your life worrying about voter turnout and disengagement and the other half your life worrying about people who haven't got a right wanting to vote in your country.
I'm always for expanding rights rather than contracting them. So I think a number of things can give you rights, and it doesn't have to be nationality.
Mm. I mean, I have a feeling about freedom of movement, which is you're going to file this under my stupid optimism, which always makes me look foolish. But I have a feeling that people tend not to want to leave where they live unless it's terrible.
Yes.
And they already leave when it's terrible. So I have a feeling that you could say every border is free everywhere in the world and actual immigration wouldn't change that much.
I think our choices are between accepting that human beings move and always have moved, and we would either accept that reality with or without killing them for moving. And that is the option. The option isn't free movement. The option is, do you want to kill people for moving?
And I don't know how that will fare against climate change, because I think at the moment people move when their countries are at war, and... You know, obviously, when you add to that when their countries are completely destroyed by the ravages of a particular weather event, then that is going to...
That's already happening. People are moving.
Exactly. And people argue that many wars are kind of founded in the seeds of climate change anyway. I think now is probably a time at which we could make our peace with accepting people's movement without killing them, and just kind of build the structures in which they can be accepted for when there are... more people moving in more of a hurry.
And as we've seen from this discussion, and I'm sure this is a colonial legacy Britain, I mean, so many of our rules around this are a complete mess, right? You know, we have rights to vote for colonial
Well, I was shocked. I could vote the instant I got here, and I'd lived in America for 10 years, but an Indian passport entitled me to vote. Whereas people who were living here didn't.
I feel like part of the failures of the progressive side generally have been that there are certain ideas which are considered so problematic, among them freedom of movement, a borderless globe, reparations for the exploitation of the past, that, you know, these ideas which sound incredibly expensive and incredibly scary, that the left simply doesn't bring them up. Can you envisage a situation in which people will talk about them with less fear or not?
I think they have to be grappled with. Yes, I can envisage it. As a teacher, I have difficult conversations with students all the time. I find young people very willing, in fact, keen to have discussions about things like reparations and commemorations. I find young people, they don't shy away from grappling with difficulty. But I think that we, who are older, have to make sure that we don't shut down difficult discussions and that we actually take our cue from them.
I was shocked that the Let Us Vote principles got through at the Labour Party conference, even if the Labour Party might well drop them now in terms of an automatic voting right based on residency and not citizenship, and a much more open free movement policy. So, you know, actually it does show, if you make the argument that you can.
So that's a really good example. That and the free movement argument is, you know, you have young people putting something on the table and then older people going, oh my God.
Kind of morally shamed into adopting it.
It's amazing. Yeah. Sorry, I just had an idea for a column, but carry on.
That concludes the podcast for those listening on the podcast platforms. The podcast is going from strength to strength, but we need your help to keep it sustainable and to expand. That's why we've introduced extra time available for paid-up members of Another Europe Is Possible. To join the campaign, go to anothereurope.org/join. In this week's extra time, we'll ask Priya about her predictions for the current crisis in British politics. Thanks to Priya, and thanks to you for listening. If you really love today's podcast, then please take a few moments to leave a rating or review on your podcast platform. That way, even more people get to hear about these groundbreaking ideas. You can also contact us on podcast@anothereurope.org with feedback and suggestions for new content. We'll be back very soon. See you then.
So, Boris Johnson. I mean, I'm surprised by how extreme he is. I think everybody's kind of head is spinning. What do you make of it? What are your predictions for where we're going?
Well, one thing I will say that, again, as someone who hails from Modi's India, I am less surprised and less taken aback by the phenomena that Boris Johnson and Donald Trump represent. We have to situate what is happening in Britain in the global rise of an extreme right, a right that is both murderous and suicidal in certain ways. So after the 2014 election in India, I warned about that election in The Guardian, and I now look back on the piece that I wrote, and it was an optimistic piece because everything I said would go wrong did go wrong and worse. So I think that we can understand people like Boris Johnson and Donald Trump only if we look at things in a global frame rather than just a Western frame. Boris Johnson is deeply dangerous, but he's one of very many deeply dangerous figures across the globe, including, of course, Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, Erdogan in Turkey, Putin, of course. And I think what we are seeing is the global rise of an agreement on authoritarianism as the way to govern and on mobilizing xenophobia as the mode to get your will implemented. But we're also seeing the global rise of untruth. We know that one of Boris Johnson's characteristics is that he lies fairly shamelessly, in my opinion. We've seen Donald Trump do a version of this. You see versions of this happening in different places. So what is the prediction? My prediction is that things are bad and going to get worse unless we organize across national lines. We pay attention to what is happening in the non-West. We pay attention to how capitalism relies now on authoritarian states and on figures who will both espouse neoliberalism and xenophobia. This is a common cocktail across the globe. And I think if we don't do this on a global scale, then we are just going to see various versions of Groundhog Day where Boris Johnson and Brexit and Trump are concerned.
I think there's something to do with the machismo that I always find it difficult to describe around some of these figures. I mean, Trump was in Austria this week, so Strache, the disgraced leader of the far right there.
And can you tell us what brought the Austrian far right down, like in a nutshell?
Hasn't really been brought down. Well, as you find out from the other podcast we're publishing this week, but Ruth Bodak explains that it was actually the second crisis that led to a loss of their votes, but it wasn't covered by the international media. So the second crisis was that Strache was found to be stealing money to the tune of an expenses budget of 40,000 euros a month. So stealing money from the Austrian taxpayer, the first crisis, and pawning the country to Russian oligarchs was fine for some reason. And, you know, loads of this justification around it. Oh, well, she was a very attractive woman, like young woman. Of course, they were taken in by them. There's, and I suppose that links to the machismo thing, right? Yeah. There is something about this kind of low expectations of white male behaviour that then becomes kind of politically salient into far-right, like, politics, right?
You're so not, sorry to make these hand signals to you. For the listener, I'm giving him a thumbs up. I think that's very true. I've often, because the whole strongman thing is not as simple as, you know, this is just a gorilla who gives people faith because he has the courage of a silverback. It's not that simple, but it is somewhere in what you're saying about as soon as you kind of, if somebody really marshals their masculinity as a boon, then your expectations of kind of reason and accountability and logic drop away, and then their weakness becomes their strength.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I mean, greed for resources and wealth and sexual desire running rampant over society and people's rights and aggressive masculinity, these are part of a cocktail. One other thing I would say, though, going back to the Boris Johnson question, what is very worrying across these contexts is the demise of truth and the demise of factuality. I mean, clearly Johnson and his lies on the side of a bus, for which he has not been held to account, to me is part of a larger whole in which actually you have what Trump's spokesperson called alternative facts. The truth doesn't matter, that facts don't matter, that actually you can say anything you like, and as long as people are okay with it, you can do, you know, as you please. And I think that the demise of some semblance of truth and reality and factuality, I think that should worry us very deeply as well.
I agree.
On that bombshell.
Yeah,
on that miserable. Yeah,
I'm sorry.
No. It's look, it's good to go to the worst places because at least it's not all in your head. Thank you very much.
Thank you.